Welcome to Unshackled Leadership, a lantern for Black women. This program is produced to help women of color in leadership move from their zone of excellence to their zone of genius by eliminating any false upper limits caused by race, gender, culture, or their own inner critic. This program is dedicated to the legacy of Harriet Tubman, who held a lantern in the dark for all of us. I'm your host, ICF-certified executive leadership coach, Joya Jefferson Nuri. Welcome back to Unshackled Leadership, a lantern for Black women. We focus on this show on American women and how we are segregated, left out, and minimalized in this country. But throughout the world, there are women who suffer the same plight because of the color of their skin, even if they're not a different race from the people they live around. In India, there's a caste system. And Isabel Wilkinson, in her book, Caste, pointed out to us that there's a caste system in this country also, where we decide people by their color, by their economics, by the neighborhoods, by their history, and we marginalize them because of those things. We brutalize them because of the caste system. But that's not a formal, legalized caste system in this country anymore. But in India, that caste system still exists. And for centuries, people with brown skin, born to people with brown skin, were called the untouchables. They're now called Dalit. One of my clients is an Indian woman who lives in Delhi, and she's a Dalit. And I have learned so much from her, I wanted to share it here with you. That the plight of women of color around the world looks the same. But I want you to hear what it's like to live in India. Kamana Singh is an academician. She's an artist and a passionate advocate for social inclusion in India. She's currently pursuing a PhD in the Department of English at the University of Delhi. Her research centers on the lives and writing of Dalit women in India. With a commitment to amplifying marginalized voices, Kamana has presented her work at esteemed national and international institutions, including Georgia Southern University and Columbia University. As a model, she explores the complexities of identity, aesthetics, and beauty in a caste-codified Indian society. She has done this through a social culture that told her continuously what she's not. As I have known her now for nearly 2 years, I believe what she describes to me is like being in America in the South, or anywhere in America, in the 1930s, where you were clearly free, but you were definitely not free. Kamana, welcome to Unshackled Leadership.
Thank you so much for having me here. It's a great honor to be on your podcast.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. It's a great honor to have you here. Yeah. Tell us, begin with telling us the general life of a Dalit woman in India, and then I'm going to ask you about your personal experiences. So tell us the big picture first.
So to begin with, I think it's good to tell, to discuss what exactly, like, you know, is the caste system in India, and like how are the divisions, like what kind of divisions are there in the first place. So I want to like tell you that there are four caste groups in India, and the topmost are the Brahmins or the priestly community, like caste. And then there are Kshatriyas. Kshatriyas are the supposed to be like the warrior communities. And then the Vaishnav.
The what community?
Warrior communities.
The valued community.
The warrior communities.
Warrior community. Yes. I'm sorry.
Yes. And again, they are associated with strength, physical strength, and like fights and like pride in their like warrior genetics. And then there are like Vaishyas. Vaishyas are the trader communities. They are supposed to be having like the acumen for trade and business. And then you have Shudras, which are peasants, artisans, and like supposedly like lower castes. And then even below them are the Dalits. They do not fall under any caste category. They are like supposed to like do the jobs that nobody else wants to do, like which includes manual scavenging and jobs that are generally like given the status of polluting and pollutants. So this includes manual scavenging and dealing with
their... What's scavenging?
Using your hands to clean manual like excreta of like human beings through your hands. Okay. And like dealing with the dead carcasses of animals. So the Dalit communities, which is not a singular community, it consists of multiple communities, thousands of communities rather, and they are called Dalits. And the topmost is the Brahmins. They are the people who hold the most power. And as you move downwards in the system, the power kind of like starts
to diminish.
Yeah. And so this is like broadly what the caste system in India is like. And another characteristic of the same system is that one, you are like, you can imagine it like a building wherein which has four floors without a staircase. And this is a metaphor that Dr. B.R. Ambedkar has used to describe caste in his work.
Yeah.
So like a building without a staircase, you are born there and you die there. You cannot do anything about it. You cannot, like, these are groups that do not intermarry. You cannot marry within, like, Dalit communities. And, like, we have the cases of...
Like, you could not marry a Brahmin.
Yeah. You're not, like, yeah. I think these communities are endogamous within themselves as well. But then specifically, like, you know, for a Dalit person to marry, like, in a caste privileged background, that's not allowed at all. So it's like there are honor killings to prevent that. Like people get killed if you transgress that boundary. And in India, like you marry under a special marriages act, which is not like, you know, the Hindu marriage act under which people normally get married.
Mm. Now, how is it determined? You said thousands of communities can be put into the Dalit.
Yeah.
Community into the Dalit subcaste.
Mm-hmm.
How is it determined who gets into that?
Who gets into the Dalit communities?
Yes. How is it determined? Is it skin tone? Is it family last name? Was it a determination that makes you a Dalit?
Dalit as a term, I mean, there is no identifier of it. So, for example, skin tones are not necessarily like an identifier of the same. Indians as a whole are like, you will find different shades of brown. But at the same time, like, again, we move into the direction of having a discussion about colorism and like the relationship of caste. Colorism in India, like, basically ascribes low value to a person if you are brown-skinned. But then that low-valueness is associated with caste. So I'll give you an example. So this is like a very, like a lot of my caste privileged friends tell me about this, like who are dark-skinned. So they tell me that, you know, people are just not willing to accept that they are upper castes. Because somewhere colorism as an idea in India is associated, like, or anything that is, that has, like, that has connotations of low, like bad qualities, like lowliness. I mean, they are just ascribed to Dalits. For example, if you are quote unquote non-meritorious, like as in you are not entitled to like basic human like the rights of like, you know, being mediocre.
Non-meritorious would means that you're not highly educated.
You're not right? intelligent. It's like the I mean, there is a negative cultural connotation associated with like Dalit as an identity. So if like somebody is a Dalit, they automatically become ugly. They automatically become not intelligent, not suitable for intellectual pursuits.
Yeah.
By default.
That's true here.
Yeah.
That's true here.
Yeah.
That you're even within the Black community,
mm-hmm.
if you are brown like me,
mm-hmm.
you are not as valuable as a fair-skinned Black person. If your hair is straight, you have more value. If your natural hair is straight, then you have more value. And I think that contributes to how many of us straighten our hair. I don't chemically straighten my hair, but I do blow dry it. Mm-hmm. And that's considered the standard of beauty. And so anybody who's in the Dalit community is considered less than.
Like, so Dalit communities, again, like you are born into it. It's like there is no membership or anything. You're just born into like a group of castes that are considered scheduled castes or Dalits. Dalit is a political term which was chosen by like the leader of Dalits, Dr. B.R. Ambedkar, and like somebody who is a very revered figure for us. It's like a father figure for us. And mm-hmm. Who chose the term Dalit for as a political identity, as opposed to like the term Harijan, which was chosen by Mahatma Gandhi, which literally means children of God. But then in to oppose that, Dr. B.R. Ambedkar questioned it and like asked if like, you know, if we are children of God, then who are you? Why do you separate us as children of God? So
you're saying Gandhi separated you also? I'm not following.
Yeah, that's
Gandhi. Gandhi left out the Dalit people.
Gandhi. So this is a very like infamous debate within the anti-caste circles in India, wherein Gandhi, who is not a Dalit person, who tried to be like a representative of Dalits, whereas Dr. B.R. Ambedkar, who was a member of the Dalit communities, was like fighting for the rights of like Dalits and was a representative himself. But then how his contribution was delegitimized in the face of Gandhi. Gandhi claiming ownership, and Gandhi gave the term Harijan, which means children of God, to Dalits. But then there was a lot of opposition for it, wherein Dr. B.R. Ambedkar was like, if we are children of God, then who are you? Why are you creating that separation, like of claiming us to be children of God and other, like who are other people in that case?
So he wanted a more inclusive.
He wanted something that is more assertive, which is the term Dalit. Dalit literally means broken, crushed.
I see.
And it was first.
So he was more militant.
Yeah.
I would say I'm trying. Yeah.
Yes.
So, okay. He was more militant about it than Gandhi.
Yes.
It sounds to me like you were saying Gandhi sort of glazed over it by saying children of God.
Yes.
As opposed to, no. There's nothing polite about this.
Yes. It's like how you see women as goddesses in India, but then like how women, like you just romanticize them or like put them on a pedestal, but then you continue to treat women a certain way. It's like, again, I mean, you term people as children of God, but then like you still discriminate against them. You treat them as untouchables. What is so like godly about it?
Yeah.
That's something that Ambedkar protested against. And again, he used the term Dalit, which was again used by one of the very early leaders from the community, Jyotiba Phule, in the 19th century, who first used the term Dalits for like oppressed castes. And then the legacy of the same was taken up by Dr. B.R. Ambedkar in 1935 to protest against Gandhi's use of Harijan.
The name was untouchable before Children of God and then Dalit.
The name was there were derogatory terms. There was no name for Dalits. There were derogatory caste names.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I can tell you those names. They are not a pleasant sound. Even till date, they're used as caste slurs.
Yeah.
In India.
Yeah. And I don't want to hear
in
the slurs.
Popular culture, like, you know, you see them in cinema, people, like, you know, just using them very casually to just make remarks about people. For example, if somebody is not looking very decked up or anything, you use a caste slur that, you know, you're looking like so-and-so person and insert the caste slur there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the same thing here with the word nigger.
Yeah. Yes,
it was.
Exactly.
It was created to demean.
Yes.
Okay. It was created to demean. In the 1990s, as rap began, 80s, 70s, 80s, when rap began, a generation of black men and women decided to own the name and take the edge off of it.
Exactly. Yeah.
And instead of allowing the white race to use it against us, we just took it and decided to own it. And it became our word. It is still not permissible for them to use it without having a fist fight. But we owned it, and it took the sting off for a lot of people. It didn't for me, but it took a sting off of it for a lot of people, which is... To own it made sense to me to do that. But thank you for that overview. So tell me your story of being a Dalit woman.
Where do we start? Where do you, like, do you have any specific?
Well, I would like to start with you, despite being born into this caste, you are pursuing a PhD, and you write, and you present before huge bodies of people in your country, in Australia. You travel, you present. What I know about you, that you read African-American women writers who are part of the resiliency, from bell hooks to Alice Walker. Tell us how you came from being this Dalit child to being this advocate.
I don't know how it all began. And it's like I just had a lot of questions about myself. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I had a very lonely childhood, and with, like, my parents migrating from, like, a very notorious space in India, like, called UP to Delhi, and then them having to, like, face the alienation and everything, and suddenly been put in a, like, environment that is actively hostile, but not in a very out-and-out way, and them having to grapple with their own anxieties and that getting, like, sort of pushed on to me. And I was very clueless about what was happening. I knew about my caste identity ever since, like, I mean, with my consciousness. I mean, I was a child, I knew about it. Even as a child, I knew about all of it. It's just that, I mean, I could never accept that. I was very confused about it. What does it even mean to be, like, a Dalit person? And, like, can I do something about it? I mean, I remember asking my mother when I was, like, very young, can I change my caste identity? Like, I was probably, like, 5-7 years old, and very, very in my, like, very naive moment, I just went up to my mother and asked her, like, you know, can I change my caste identity? And my mother, like, I don't know how she responded. I just don't know what was her response. But everybody in my family, like, we live in Delhi. We live by keeping shut about our caste identity. But despite that, we are not able to, like, we are not able to really keep shut about it. So the reason why I say this is because there is an emerging discourse among the anti-caste circles in India. And I'm sure this concept is something that you're aware of, the concept of passing. Because Indians are homogeneous and Indians look like in all look different, like different shades of brown and everything. There's a concept of passing, that you change your last name.
And passing.
Yes. And that you pretend to be a caste privileged person. But that has not been possible for me. I live in a very North India dominated part of Delhi. And wherein, like, skin tones, like, you have signposts over your body, over, like, the way you speak, where your family is from. These questions are in everyday conversation. You go to people's places, their parents ask you, what is your caste identity? Where are you from? And, like, I have encountered these questions ever since, like, I was a child. I mean, people wouldn't let their children play with me. In my school, like, the play school teacher would just beat me up for randomly no reasons. My parents changed my class section like twice. And even
because she hit you?
Yeah, she used to hit me like left, right and center. And then I would just be so scared that I wouldn't want to go back to the school. And
she would hit you because of your caste?
I looked a certain way, which was not like I was not, quote unquote, the kind of, like, my body did not show that I come from a, like, quote-unquote, a caste-privileged background or a good background. So the way I look, like, with my brown skin and everything, it is a signifier of me being from, like, a low caste. It's my caste identifier. In a North India, like, it's not necessary that skin tones become identifiers everywhere, but then colorism in India is rooted in caste. And when people are trying to, like, figure out where you are from and everything, my skin tone has always become my identifier. It's like,
and you know, and I want to add this for those people who know this podcast and know what I look like, and Kamina's picture will be in the description. Kamina and I are about the exact same complexion. We are about exactly the same skin tone. And despite what she just said, she's absolutely gorgeous. But so please continue. I just wanted to give the audience some reference on what your skin tone looks like.
It's like fair skin is associated with your good genes that are, again, like, associated with caste-privileged people.
Yeah.
So the more closer, like, you are to the oppressor, like, even among Dalits, there are fair-skinned people. So it's like, what I'm trying to say is they can pass. But then some people cannot pass. I cannot pass. Even if I try to, I can't pass.
Neither could I.
That makes me, like, vulnerable to a lot more attacks. It's like, I can't imagine, like, why would you, like, I remember I was just playing in like, my garden and, like, my apartment's garden. And, like, a random woman just asked me, like, in which flat number do you work? Which was a question for, like, to figure out if I'm a domestic worker. And imagine, like, asking this to, like, a 7-8-year-old child. I couldn't, like, in her imagination, I couldn't live in that locality.
Yeah.
That I couldn't be a resident. So I must be a domestic worker. And then this is the reason why, like, these people wouldn't let their children play with me. Even in school, like, this teacher would just beat me up. And I remember this one time, this teacher just asked me to stay outside the classroom for the entire week. And I don't know, I must be talking or something, but then I don't think that this was just, like, another incident of me getting punished. And I have this weird memory of that incident, that there was, like, a classmate's birthday. I still remember the person. And that it was his birthday, and they distributed sweets. This teacher did not let him give me sweets. I was standing outside, like, for a week, and that was my punishment.
You, became this obviously was the foundation to you being such a woman of resilience and wanting to have your voice heard. But as you moved through the education system, you chose English as your major, and your English is impeccable. And I'm wondering why you chose English.
I think I did not choose English. I chose stories. I was more interested in stories, and even in my school, I mean, something that always kept me going has been stories. And like for this reason, like I get a lot of criticism as well, that like in my family, that they never understood what will I do, that was I even like intelligent enough, smart enough, because again, I was not really keen on, I mean, I did not know anything, to be honest, now that I think about it from today's perspective. I did not have any vantage point. My father finished his education when I was in my 10th grade. So him and me, we were literally just like doing our studies together. And I had nobody to like seek opinions from, that or any kind of help or mentorship, that, you know, what subject should I choose, or what do I do with whatever limited information or limited access that I have. And even in my school, my parents put me like in a school which again became like a hotbed of bullying and repeated like discrimination of all kinds. And I remember that when I was in my high school, I was not allowed to study certain subjects because there was some random aptitude tests wherein you just check, like select some check boxes. And based on that, I was like, despite having the score, despite scoring 80% in my 10th grade, I was not given like the subjects that I wanted to have.
And what subjects were you denied?
I wanted to take up sciences, but then I was denied on the pretext of them saying that I don't have the aptitude for it. Today, like when I have worked in the education sector and when I know a little bit about cognitive science and how do our brain learns, I can question that. I mean, on what basis, what was that like given to me? And I know, like, even in my school...
You mean denied to you? Yeah. Why was that denied to you?
Yeah, and my parents were not English-speaking, and they always thought that maybe, like, you know, these teachers know better and everything, and they also made that idea about me that, you know, maybe she's not good enough. This is why she did not get sciences. And
so you got this from your parents also?
Yeah. I mean, it's like they did not know any better, to be honest. They just enter here and imagine, like, teachers, like, in a school... speaking a certain language, coming from a certain background, talking to my parents specifically in a certain way based on like where they are coming from and everything. So that schools have, they don't have like a place for people like me. And it's like, I mean, my teachers outside the school, once I've left the school and everything, they have congratulated me for handling my bullying gracefully. Yeah, bullying gracefully, yeah, in quotes. These are like her words, or I've had the fallout.
Yes.
Yeah, and I was like, that means everybody knew about it, what was happening. Mm-hmm. Still nobody did anything.
Yeah.
I was...
But now... Wait, please continue.
Yeah, I was a very weak child, weak in terms of physically weak. I mean, I was anemic and I had low BP very frequently. I would just faint. And like... I remember my discomfort with one of my dance teachers back in the school, and because this person was verbally abusive and physically abusive as well. I refused to dance on my annual day because this person would, every year he would just give me one role of a like dark skinned, like demon sort of thing because of my skin tone, and because of which I got bullied. So I was like, I don't want to do that, but I couldn't refuse it, and he would file a complaint to the principal, and like as a result of which I got slapped by my principal. In the history of my school, I'm the only person who got slapped by the principal in front of the entire school, after which I fainted. And I mean, it's like, I don't know like how to even process that.
Yeah. You know, as you know, everybody comes with an inner critic.
Yeah.
That voice.
Yeah.
So, as we've said, you are now in a PhD program. You have this movement that you want to be a part of and initiate and sustain. But how did you battle what would be innately your inner critic, with your outward constantly being heard, being told what you're not, you can't be, you're limited, even coming from your parents, your neighborhood. But yet you figured out how to continually break through. Can you talk about that for a little bit?
Yeah, I think that has been a constant battle. And I think it was something that I was like, I picked up writing again after like a year and a half, probably. I was just writing it day before yesterday that I don't grieve in my therapy sessions. I grieve when I'm able to do the things, when I accomplish things that I was told that I will never be able to accomplish.
That means grieving? Well, that creates grieving?
Yes, that you creates said, grieving. Because
when you accomplish something, you grieve?
Yes.
Tell me about
That's the only time. Like, I don't grieve in my therapy sessions. This is why they were not working for me when I was in therapy back, like, 2 years ago. But whenever I do things that I was told that I was told that I would, I was not beautiful. I felt ugly throughout. It's like, I've always felt ugly. And I was told that I was not smart.
You, do you mind if we talk a little bit about what we talk about in coaching?
Yeah, we can.
On the podcast? So I have your permission to go into that.
Yes.
Thank you. When we began, you were as conflicted as you are right now. But these things that you have done and accomplished, you've done since you went to coaching. You've did all that work. You did all of that work. You worked hard to overcome the voices of being brown in India. And you've come, I want to say to you, you have come a tremendously long way. And I want you to talk about where you are now, how you process now. And I want to say to the audience, this has nothing to do with me as a coach. I ask her powerful questions and she does the work. So tell us about the work and your tools to overcome a lifetime of being told you weren't pretty. I also want to add that for a moment there, you were a model and you're beautiful. And it's simply your circumstances that would make that true. Circumstances that brown skin American women have suffered from day one of hitting this continent. But I want you to talk about your process and what's in your toolkit so that you can speak before Columbia University. You can be on a PhD program. You can write. You can align yourself with Alice Walker and bell hooks.
Yeah. I mean, I have grown up like with that sense of self that creates barriers for me, that told me that this is what I cannot do, that this is how I cannot look, that I cannot be confident, I cannot be smart, I cannot ask questions. I have to just conform. That is the self-image, or like, you know, when you're growing up, yourself gets created by your experiences, by your mentors, by the people that you're surrounded with. But throughout my experience, like, the only sense of self that was getting created had mostly the limits to my being. And that in itself became my motivation to do everything that I was told that I will never be able to do. So the biggest motivator that I had was that I was told that I can't be this, I can't be that. And that was my primary reason to tell myself for sure that this, like, can I really not do that? let me try it myself and then see. And then that became my motivator. And then when you came to my life, that was like a very apt time. And I was just very lost at that time, about to just give up on everything, because no matter what I do, no matter how much I excelled at my education, no matter what accomplishments do I have, like how like easily I would just get reduced to my caste identity. I've had people like who come up like in my, like who live in my like surroundings only, and they come up and ask me like, you know, your parents don't look educated enough and everything. Who inspired you to be that educated? And I don't know, like, what do they mean by it? And then this was immediately followed up with my with a question about my caste identity.
But you know, I just ask you about your present, and like you normally do, you go back to let the inner critic do the talking. And so you have identified your past. You have identified where you live now. But I want you to share with the audience how you keep going in the programs that you're in, and be in the present as you're telling that story, please.
I try to slow down my breathing often. I do my affirmations. And I write. I try to like bring back the alignment that I had with my feelings, and something that I lost in the last few years, the disconnect that got created between my being and my feelings. I'm trying to bridge that gap by writing and reconnecting with myself. Like, writing works very well for me to connect with how I'm feeling. And my affirmations every day, they help. And reading helps. And the vocabulary for all these things, the vocabulary to understand what is happening with me, that I got from Black African-American writers that I keep referring to, bell hooks in our like discussions, we do bring up bell hooks, Alice Walker. And these are the writers that have like resonated with me. I couldn't find anything of like in the Indian literature that could resonate with me, that could actually talk to me. And this was my primary reason why I took up research in English literature. And like Toni Morrison was the first text that broke my heart and also mended it. And no other text had that power. No other author could give me like the vocabulary to understand my own experience. I just thought maybe these are just my own feelings. I am just very underconfident. I have a low self-esteem. I just did not know like what exactly was going on. Like the first time I came across these writings, Alice Walker's The Color Purple, that text spoke to me. They gave me that vocabulary. They made me feel safe. I think this helps me just keep going, that, you know, I'm not alone.
Yeah. Yeah, that's Kamna. I hear you now. You're not alone. You're not alone. You're not alone on the planet. You're not alone in the being the resilient woman of color. In one of our episodes, another one of the episodes I just recorded recently that will air near your date of airing, your debut of airing, is with Sunyan Barahona, and she is a Nicaraguan woman who fought the good fight for the equality of women in a dictatorship of Nicaragua, and was arrested and held in solitary confinement for 606 days. She was violently arrested in front of her 3-year-old child. And what she said at the end of our interview was, the dictatorship, she is now in the United States, and she's been out now for about a year. And she said that the dictatorship arrested her, tortured her to break her, but just the opposite happened. She has elected not to hate them, because hate is only going to eat her. But she is now resolved to write, to share her stories, and to form an organization in the United States that would encompass women of color around the world in the fight for their dignity and freedom. I, one, want to introduce you to her, and because you have the same story, and you have the same stories I have been saying here over and over again with all of us. And I want to commend you for being brave enough to withstand the torture of your childhood, teen years, 20s, and where you live, because people don't ever identify that class system as torture, but it is. Would you agree?
Yeah, I mean, it's not even acknowledged as something. People in India just camouflage it with their culture. Like, it's so, like, intertwined with their day-to-day lives. Like, for example, keeping separate cups and plates for, like, domestic helps. And practicing, like, again, you go out and see and talk to people, like, you know, about affirmative action. You will see hostility everywhere. People not acknowledging the generational access, the generational social capital that their caste identities have given them, and the caste pride that they take in. Like, they talk about their royal blood. I mean, I used to have a classmate who would talk about how they are so-and-so clan of Brahmins, that they can't really sit with, like, so-and-so people. So she would ask me about my caste identity and would be like, you know, I'm asking this because I belong to so-and-so, like, Brahmins, and we can't really do that. And I would be just so clueless, like, as a...
I'm clueless to all of the hatred that'll happen based on somebody's skin color or the language they speak. There's a lot of insecurity in human beings that we can only feel good if we demean somebody else. And it's been going on since the beginning, the origin story, whichever origin story you believe.
Yeah, I mean, it's like there is no respect for diversity or for human lives. There is a fundamental lack of love, compassion, and empathy for people. Because if you feel compassionate towards human beings, you wouldn't treat somebody like this. It's like that something that forces you to, like, assert your power over people who do not have that power. I mean, there's this... Baby Kamle is a Dalit writer. Like, she primarily writes in Marathi. And I can think about one instance that she mentions in her, like, book about how, like, when Dalits had segregated, like, living area, they tried, like, there they wanted to leave the occupation that was pushed on them, that they were supposed to do, like, just doing manual scavenging and, like, all the things that were, again, polluting, that were the very fundamental characteristic of, like, you know, their caste identity. So they tried to change their occupation. They tried to put up shops and everything. And how people, caste privileged people, wouldn't just buy from them. How economy was controlled by them. Economy, like, you control their economic status, you control their educational access, you control their social cultural capital. Obviously, you will always have, like, a group of people that you can dominate. And this is where the militancy comes from. And the fundamental lovelessness, in bell hooks terms, that there is fundamental lack of love in the society, that you do not see another human being as human being, that you do feel the need to, like, control the other person in order to feel good about yourself.
If you had to say something to the women of color who listen to this podcast, we have an audience in the United States and in West Africa. We're making an attempt to have it picked up in other places where they speak English, where there are lots of women of color. What would you say? What would be your message to them?
Trust your instinct, trust yourself, and never let anybody tell you what you can or cannot do. Because that's the fundamental tool that people use against you. Like, and this is how they break you. Like, violence, also, like, the first act of violence happens in the mind. it trains you to teach, it trains you to think about yourself in a certain way. And that is when, like, you, and that is what keeps you boxed throughout your life. And never let that happen. Like, that has happened to me and I'm trying to break through it because I never accepted it. A part of me could never accept it, that this is how powerless I am. As like, a part of me fundamentally did not accept it. And the need to practice my agency, the need to be, the need to claim my humanity, the need to claim my right to be a human being, that just kept me going. I think that is an instinct that is there within all of us. I think keep that safe. That would be my message.
Kamna, thank you very much for being a guest here on Unshackled Leadership. It has been my honor to talk to you, and even more my honor to know you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us.
It's been great. I mean, you have been my godmother, so.
And it's been my honor.
Nothing has worked for me, like, other than, like, your company and your support and your love towards me.
Indeed. Indeed. I have such respect for you.
Thank you so much.
I want to thank all of you for joining us here on Unshackled Leadership. I hope you will join us again. Click subscribe. See you in the next show. I want to thank you for joining us for another episode of Unshackled Leadership, A Lantern for Black Women. I want to thank the people who make this all possible, beginning with our senior producer, India Tisdale of It Takes Pure Effort Consulting. And our program editor is Grammy Award nominated singer and obviously extraordinary editor, Carolyn Malachi. Dominica Eldridge of Unique Creatives created our phenomenal artwork. And Hotham of HothamMusic.com created the theme song that you listen to every single show. Again, thank you for joining us, and I hope that you will be here for our next episode. Peace and blessings.